Good morning, everyone. This is Judge Rovner from home. I want to apologize to all of you because this is not as easy or convenient as it should be, but we will do our very best. I will ask the lawyers to be kind enough to say their names very clearly from the start, because I do not have my cards with me. And if need be, perhaps one of the marshals can let me know how much time is remaining.
We can do that, Alana.
Oh, yeah. Great. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Case number 1-072831, RLI Insurance versus Conseco.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Kevin Butler on behalf of the defendant's appellants, who are appealing a decision of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Indiana, Indianapolis Division, in which the District Court denied the defendant's motions for summary judgment on two of their counterclaims and granted plaintiffs cross motions for partial summary judgment on two of their claims. Back in April of 2000, there were a number of lawsuits filed against Conseco and some of its subsidiaries and its officers and directors. And this case is primarily about two issues. One, the misinterpretation of a release agreement in connection with those actions, and two, the conduct of RLI, the defendant, in denying a claim for coverage.
Mr. Butler, if we cut to the chase here,
yes.
Doesn't in any way related mean in any way related? It seems to me that the plain language means that even if two actions were even just slightly related, RLI would be off the hook for coverage. And in this case, the lawsuits were more than a little related. So what I need you to do, I suppose, is explain how we get around the plain language.
Well, if you apply the plain language of that phrase in any way related, in this case to this release, you're rendering portions of that release superfluous and without meaning. And the reason why is you have to take a look at the entire agreement here. This release was executed in two parts over a five-month period of time. The original release released derivative actions. There was a consolidated suit that involved both derivative actions and securities actions. And then there were some derivative actions outside that consolidated complaint. And the derivative actions were released in this original agreement along with anything ancillary to those derivative actions, such as bad faith claims, attorney's fees claims, anything such as that. They also released partially some of the securities litigation claims with regard to bad faith and other ancillary matters such as that. But there was a distinction made in that original release between types of claims, and the facts underlying both the derivative actions and in the securities actions were virtually identical. And if you read derivative actions any way related to the derivative actions, you don't need to have that second paragraph about securities litigation. It's completely, that entire paragraph is completely meaningless. Because if you apply that dictionary definition, that first term, derivative actions, everything's covered in that, everything. If it's supposed to have that broad meaning, then everything's covered and you don't need to get to the securities litigation in the next paragraph. 5 months later, they supplemented the agreement for a number of purposes, but the phrase anyway related was also adopted in that release. And again, they listed derivative actions. Instead of having two different paragraphs, they had one paragraph, and they had derivative actions listed there, and then a comma, And then there was another type of action, securities litigation, and then a comma, and then coverage litigation. This list was completely unnecessary if you're reading the contract in the broad terms that the district court did, because everything, again, is covered under that district, under that derivative litigation language that was contained in the original release. Furthermore, if you look at both of those releases and in connection with the extrinsic evidence that we submitted to the court of the negotiations over that release, that language, underlying facts, was actually proposed by the defendant, RLI. They proposed that they release all claims arising out of the underlying facts of these cases. And that was negotiated out of the contract. They didn't include that. And that
but I still do not understand how that language would help Conseco, because the Russell litigation arises out of the same facts that underlie the securities litigation.
It arises out of some of the same facts, but we're talking about two different acts here. We're talking about the ERISA Act on one hand and securities violations on the other hand. We're talking about facts that have to do with the management of a fund under the ERISA claims. And then on this, in the securities fraud and derivative actions, we're talking about statements, fraudulent statements based on fraudulent accounting practices and that sort of thing. So the nature of the claims are completely different, and that's what we're talking about in the releases. In both of the releases, we're talking about claims rather than facts.
But the Russell action was based on the same alleged malfeasance by Conseco and was more than a little related. It was a nearly identical action, wasn't it?
Well, I don't think it was a nearly identical action. I think you're talking about two different parts of the company, first of all, and one of them is managing a fund, and you're talking about the mismanagement of a fund. I think those are significantly different facts than the facts with relation to the securities fraud allegations, which were about making public statements about, fraudulently reporting earnings and things along that line.
But see, it seems to me you're kind of splitting hairs, because I have the same view as Judge Rovner that the allegations in both actions are similar. The actions both rely on the same series of SEC filings by Conseco, the same alleged misconduct by Conseco executives, and so, you know, I'm still having trouble seeing why that they're different.
Well, if you look,
so different that the district court was wrong in its conclusion.
I'm not saying that there's no similarities or there's no relation between the underlying facts. There is some underlying facts that are similar and even related on this. But that's not what the release was releasing, was claims arising out of the underlying facts. That language came out of the supplemental release itself without looking at the original release. And if you apply this term underlying facts, which was taken out of the release agreement, specifically negotiated out, if you apply underlying facts in there, yes, they're related. If you have that language, underlying facts, but that was negotiated out. And if you are talking about the underlying facts, you're making this whole portion of the supplemental release meaningless. The supplemental release was designed to expand the scope of coverage from the original release. There was an expansive provision in there. And if you're adding securities litigation, claims arising out of securities litigation, claims arising out of the coverage litigation, to the claims arising out of the derivative action, you're not adding anything if you're looking at this in the context of underlying facts, because the derivative actions, the underlying facts of there, were similar enough to the ERISA claims that if you're talking about underlying facts, they're related. But that's not what the release means, because, you know, this was a large change from the original release to the supplemental release. They're in that very paragraph, paragraph 13, they're talking about expanding the coverage from the original release. And that original release covered the underlying facts. If it covered the underlying facts, it covered the underlying facts for the securities litigations, and you didn't need to put that in the supplemental release. Furthermore,
what did it mean to supplant? Someone used that word, and expand. Supplant and expand.
Well, it's changing the terms of paragraphs 13 and 14 of the original release, but it also expands. So there's two concepts there. One, it's replacing, but with reference to the original release as the baseline. We're not going to do anything less than that what was in the original release. And they say nothing in this release is going to lessen the scope of the first release. So you have to look back to that original release to see the scope of that second release. Parts of that second supplemental release were incorporated into the agreement itself, and I think both of these documents have to be read together. And if you look at the way they drafted the original, they attempted to draft the original release. This is the language from that draft. It was a release from any and all claims the Conseco-related parties now have or may have against the RLI-related parties based on arising or in any way related to the litigation and the allegations giving rise to the litigations or the facts underlying or giving rise to the litigation. That's the part of this contract that's not there in the actual final form. It was taken out. They negotiated it. It was rejected. They chose to go with a distinction on different types of claims rather than the types of facts. And that's the distinction between these releases, is that any way related does not apply the dictionary definition, because if it did, then all this other negotiation over the release and all this other stuff is completely meaningless. We have a third, you know, when this case was first tendered to RLI, this release, this anyway related language was not so clear to RLI that it applied like the district court did. They waited 13 months before they even brought up this idea of the release applying to bar coverage in this case. 13 months, a year and a month, they didn't even think of bringing up the release. This was something clearly the parties did not intend, that an ERISA claim was going to be barred by this release. These were two different policies. This was a fiduciary liability policy that covered ERISA claims and a directors and officers liability policy that covered the securities actions. And this release was in relation to the directors and officers liability policy. Had nothing to do with the ERISA litigation. There were no ERISA actions brought in the consolidated complaint. None. It had nothing to do with ERISA. This release was about securities litigation, securities fraud class actions and derivative actions.
Would it have been better to have some sort of reservation in it to say what it did not include? Because that's what we get to here. If there had been something, you know, a paragraph say this does not include, and whatever you're trying to say it does not include, it seems to me when you get into these kinds of really high level negotiations, someone would have said, well, you know, this has to have certain brackets or parameters to it, wouldn't it?
I think if just looking at the laws of interpretation on this thing, you can't interpret the policy without looking with making certain provisions. And this is a pretty substantial provision, meaningless.
Well, look, I'm not looking for extrinsic evidence or what was negotiated in or out. I'm just saying what we have here. It would be obviously a lot easier for all of us.
Well, it would be a lot easier. I mean, you have to understand this Russell matter, this ERISA litigation was filed on the last day of the statute of limitations on the same day they executed the release. They did not foresee ERISA litigation coming down the pike. They just didn't. It was a surprise to them. It came the same day they executed the release, the very same day. So I don't think that you can anticipate every single thing that's going to happen in a contract. But I think the language of this contract clearly leaves out this, it's clear, especially if you're looking at the extrinsic evidence, that they did not intend to have the underlying facts. In fact, in the approved settlement of the securities litigation settlement, the stipulation settlement, the court had a release in that document as well, in that stipulation of settlement, and they considered whether they wanted the underlying facts to be released from that document. And this is what the court wrote in their opinion. They said This is not the release agreement we're talking about.
Which court is this?
This is the district court who settled the consolidated securities fraud class action litigation.
Right.
And when they were defining what claims were released in that order and what parties were releasing, they said release claims mean any and all manner of action against any and all released persons for based on, by reason of, or arising from, or relating to the conduct alleged in the consolidated class action. That's very different from this language. You know, the people who participated in the settlement of this document, the stipulated settlement, were the same people who drafted this release. This is the language they put in that release when they wanted to relate it to conduct alleged in the underlying suit, the underlying facts, when they wanted the relation to be the underlying facts. They put it directly in the order, arising from or relating to the conduct alleged. That's the exact same thing RLI proposed in their draft, is that they wanted it related to the underlying facts, and that was rejected. It was taken out of the contract. And so we're talking about different types of claims. And what was released in that original release and that supplemental release was the claim, any more derivative actions or securities fraud actions, or any of the ancillary claims that come along with it, the bad faith claims, breach of duty of good faith, attorney's fees claims, things of that nature. That's what they were talking about, and it makes sense if you look at the whole totality of the agreement, what they were trying to do. They had exhausted a policy. They had exhausted their policy on the directors and officers liability. They were done. RLI was done with that. We don't want any more of these claims coming. This was a different policy. This ERISA claim was a completely different policy.
What should we make of the fact that Conseco gave the wrong policy number when it first sent that notification letter to RLI about the Russell litigation?
Well, I think they sent 1120 instead of 1120A, and there was a letter sent back from RLI that within a couple days saying this policy's expired.
Right.
We sent a letter back the next day saying we're this is an ERISA claim, and we left out that A. It was 1120A, I think, and they just put 1120. So I think it was just a clerical error on that fact. But they were clearly going for the policy under the ERISA policy, not the directors and officers policy, because that was exhausted and released. The issue of this release came as a total surprise to Conseco a year and a month later. They never raised it. RLI never raised the issue of this release when they tendered this claim. Never. For 13 months. They said, we're investigating issues of coverage. Investigating issues of coverage under the policy. We're investigating under a reservation of rights to find issues of coverage under the insurance contract. Those are the words from their letters that they were telling RLI or telling Conseco.
So you're saying you had two policies with separate premiums?
Two policies, separate premiums. I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal, if that's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Butler.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Michael Progh, P-R-O-U-G-H, representing RLI Insurance Company.
Thank you, Mr. Progh, for spelling your name. Thank you.
Okay. I believe Judge Mannion's question earlier isn't Conseco disregarding, in fact, a clause in the original release is exactly the case. I want to get to this issue briefly to refute what Conseco said, but in doing so, I don't want to leave the impression that the scope of interpretation of the derivative clause release is even fairly in play, because this argument is a new argument on appeal by Conseco, as is about three-quarters of its brief. They were represented by Kirkland and Ellis and then Foley and Lardner in the trial court proceeding. We litigated for years. We collectively spent millions of dollars. We defeated every argument Kirkland and Ellis and Foley and Lardner can think of. And then a new firm comes on appeal and makes a bunch of new arguments. I'm not sure what an argument here that says, okay, this case was released under the original release, and then 6 months later, a new release was executed, and that would also release it. I'm not sure where that gets Conseco.
You know, can I just ask you this? In its opening brief, Conseco asks rhetorically, what was accomplished by rewriting paragraphs 13 and 14 of the original release into their new forms in the supplemental agreement? And I was wondering if you could answer this.
Sure, absolutely. And this gets back to the point that, that Judge Mannion raised, which is paragraph 15 of the original release. And I think reading in context where the party stood at that time, I mean, this, I've had the benefit of living this case for about 8 years, so I can remember this time frame, but we, underlying securities action was settling with a large payment of money. RLI contributed its $10 million in limits under the D&O policy under a full reservation of rights, including the right to get it back. And in the course of doing so, the parties executed this release where Conseco gave RLI releases as to certain items, as to the derivative action and also as to claim handling relating to the securities action. But paragraph 15 of the original release expressly carves out from the releases matters relating to the securities action so that the securities action defendants can continue to argue for coverage against RLI and RLI can continue to pursue its reimbursement claim without saying basically, aha, you've released any right to claim coverage from us. So the original release, because of where it happened in the context of ongoing coverage litigation, had a carve-out. And so then 6 months later, that coverage litigation settles, and we give up our $10 million reimbursement claim. And in connection with that, the release is broadened to include everything in any way related to any of this, derivative action, securities action, coverage litigation, in the broadest possible language. And I think there was an argument by Conseco's counsel that everyone was only thinking about the RLI excess policy. You may note the language of the release says, any claim for coverage under any policy of insurance issued by RLI, including the RLI excess policy, that's based on arising out of or in any way related to the derivative action, securities action, or coverage litigation.
So, when Conseco notified you about the Russell litigation, why didn't RLI immediately realize that the Russell litigation was precluded from coverage by the terms of the release agreement and notify Conseco to that effect immediately, rather than waiting until after Conseco had finished defending itself within its deductible? After all, Conseco is maintaining that it sent the notice of the Russell litigation to the same person who had negotiated the release agreement.
If I may, Your Honor, the as you may note in the correspondence that occurred there, I think both we had a letter from Conseco in early January just giving us notice of the lawsuit. Attorney Rasmussen sends an acknowledgement of that letter with a reservation of rights. He, by virtue of a different claim that's not even at issue here, but is referenced a couple of times, Cobb. Mr. Rasmussen obviously is aware of the policy period of the policy that had been tendered under, notifies them of that issue so that they can notify any later carriers they may have. You'll see in the letter, it's not a declination. It's a, because this policy has expired, you may want to notify your later carriers as well. In fact, you know, I'll leave it at that. There was a full reservation of rights, certainly not a declination on that basis. And then Mr. Rasmussen asks for additional information, further pleadings, what's gone on. We are, for the first year, not only is the case largely stayed because of Conseco's bankruptcy, nothing's going on, Conseco's defending itself within the $100,000 deductible, self-insured retention, whatever you're going to call it, where for the first series of the loss, even the defense expenses, Conseco is running the defense. So you'll see the letters of prompt acknowledgement of request for additional information. Not the next day, as counsel, I think, just misspoke, but 6 months later, Conseco responds and says, oh, actually, you know, there's a renewal. Here's a different policy number. Mr. Rasmussen responds to that and notes, okay, that's fine. We asked for this additional information in January, additional pleadings, things that have gone on in the underlying case. Finally, that information comes in. We are notified. He also says, you know, let me know if your deductible has been satisfied. Send me any information that says that. If the deductible number is reached, it's somewhat moot. If the case stayed with bankruptcy, it's somewhat moot. And until we get additional information, I don't understand the argument. I think we cited an Indiana district court case from the last year where the judge said, are they saying we should have denied sooner or we should have denied the claim immediately based on the partial information they had sent us? And I can't believe we wouldn't be facing allegations of bad faith had we done that, had we hair-trigger denied the claim based solely on their presenting the initial tender. So it's a little bit of a catch-22. I think they're trying to argue a carrier is stuck in, where if you immediately shoot from the hip and deny, then you're going to get accused of bad faith for not looking into and investigating it. And if you say, thank you for the notice, please send us additional information, we reserve all rights, they're going to say, well, why didn't you deny then? Why didn't you tell us all your coverage issues? And I don't think the duty of good faith and fair dealing in Indiana requires that. And I think also, and we've talked about this a little as well, because there's always a risk when this case goes up on appeal, it comes to the Court of Appeal, and your honors are all seeing it for the first time, just as Conseco's counsel is seeing it for the first time. But all this mend the hold and arguments are waived if they're not mentioned in your first letter. Those arguments were never made in the district court. So to the extent anyone's saying, you know, let's point to the record, where's the testimony about that, where's the evidence, it's a brand new argument. It's a little unusual to think that you can take a judicial officer and the parties and all their time and all their effort at the trial level for several years and then come up on appeal and here's a new argument. And, well, you know, why isn't that developed in the record below? Because nobody argued it. But that being said, and you know, at risk of, I don't want to seem like we're litigating by consent here, because I'm responding to, I think, is an improper argument that they're making for the first time on appeal. It's completely wrong as well. It's an incorrect argument as well. There was not a declination. There was not a declination in either of the two letters that happened during the year that Conseco was within its deductible. As soon as Conseco notified us in January of 2004 that their deductible had been exceeded, RLI sent out the reservation of rights letter in February 2004, picking up the defense under a reservation of rights the moment its duty came into existence. And among the rights expressly laid out in a lengthy detailed letter are this the issue of the release. So
is that a common practice for this, when you do this, you reservation of rights and take up whatever the duties might be, and when you're put on notice?
Well, it's premature to be opining about a bunch of things before your duty has come into existence and before you
have... I just mean, is it a common practice in the industry? That's a general question.
Yeah, I don't know that. Honestly, it's hard to say, you know, common practice in the industry, but and I don't know, you know, there wasn't any expert testimony or anything like that on this motion, but certainly a carrier is not uncommon when a relatively complex matter is tendered to write back and ask for additional information as part of your evaluation, and then, you know, and reserve all rights, and when the loss reaches your layer by exhaustion or by the underlying deductible being exceeded, then you take your position, because your duty has arisen on whether you're going to, at that point, I mean, otherwise it's hypothetical. I mean, when they're within their deductible, they're spending their own money anyway on the defense within the deductible. That's the deal they struck. So I'm sorry if I'm not answering.
No, it's all right. I'm just looking at it in general terms.
Right, it's certainly standard for carriers to continue to investigate and take more information in the period of time before their policy is reached. And particularly if you look at a policy like this with a substantial deductible and a case, the underlying case, because of Conseco's bankruptcy, had been stayed. And it wasn't until, I think, later in 2004 that the stay was lifted as to the underlying Russell action, and O'Malveny filed the motion to dismiss. And then after that, shortly after that in January, when they told us that they had exceeded the deductible. So it's just, as I said, I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of juice in Conseco saying, well, you should have denied right out of the gate. And in any event, the argument, I don't think, is one that's been preserved. And I don't think that doctrine supports them anyway here. In any event, the Indiana courts have held, you know, that the bad faith horse limited to certain circumstances where there's been unreasonable delay and I think ill will in denying a claim without any conceivable basis and situations like that. There's simply no evidence of any of that here. So we're kind of arguing on a peripheral and improperly raised issue. And I think the real issue here is, how do we give meaning and effect to this release language in any way related to the securities action when we have a tag-along suit, Russell, that comes along that is not just, you know, by happenstance mentioning a few of the same facts, but is basically overlapping the vast majority of the claimed conduct, the claimed, you know, securities filings, all of these things. It's the exact same conduct, and in fact, the court finds Russell was a plaintiff who released his rights in the earlier settlement. Russell was a party to the prior suit and released these claims. So if the Russell case isn't in any way related to the securities action, I'm not sure what could be. It's hard to imagine a case more closely related to the securities action than Russell. And Conseco argued as much, you know, vehemently and successfully in the district court. This is Conseco's language. This case should be dismissed because it has already been litigated. The ink was hardly dry on the court's final judgment confirming the fairness of the securities action settlement when plaintiff filed this lawsuit seeking to dress up the same claims in new ERISA clothes. It goes on and on. We quoted in the brief. These are Conseco's arguments in the district court. We're not trying to hold them to something wrong. They were right. This is the exact same cluster of behavior and conduct and everything being sued upon. So I think it would take an incredibly narrow release to say, okay, everything relating to the securities action is released, but this Russell claim isn't subsumed by it. And contrary to such a narrow interpretation, in fact, the parties expressly stated several times that they intended this release and the supplemental release of October 2002 to have a broad interpretation, to be construed broadly, paragraph 17, to apply to unknown claims as well as known claims, whether or not the parties contemplate them. And so in paragraph 13, I think we have that that supplants and expands any prior release from April 2002. So I think to take all of this language with a sophisticated party, Conseco, represented by counsel, represented by in-house counsel, represented by risk managers, it's hard to imagine a larger, more sophisticated company than Conseco signing a release of this scope and magnitude, and then to come back years later and say, well, you know, we really didn't mean that. You know, we meant something a lot narrower.
Let me ask you this. If the release was so broad to begin with, what was the purpose of the supplemental agreement?
And I addressed that earlier. The securities action, which was the matter on which RLI paid the $10 million, when that settled, Conseco and RLI reserved the right to continue to dispute whether that's coverage. RLI was going to try to get the money back. Conseco was going to argue they still had their coverage positions. So when that initial $10 million was paid and that initial release was executed, there was a carve-out in paragraphs 14 and 15, specifically 15 of the original release, for the securities action issues to be argued. 6 months later, the coverage action settles, and then we have a complete release where we just throw in everything. We say securities action, coverage action, derivative action, it's all released.
You're releasing any claim you may have for reimbursement? Is that how that would work?
Yes, for our $10 million, exactly, which turned out to be a good claim on the merits. Lloyd's of London won on it later, but in a defensive posture, so there were some different issues there as to we had paid our money under a reservation of rights and needed to get it back, and Conseco had financial difficulties going on at the time. So there were different factors. But, yes, it was a substantial claim for reimbursement. There was some merit to it, and we gave it up, a $10 million claim. But in giving it up, we got prospective releases generally, broadly, to anything in any way related to the securities action, derivative action, coverage litigation. And that's all we're enforcing here. And it's, as I said, just, you know, words have meaning. And if any way related to has meaning, it's got to subsume this. And I think we have, you know, some interesting philosophical arguments, perhaps, by Conseco about, you know, the outer reaches of this release and, you know, out at the edge. Are we talking about, you know, facts, or are we talking about any way related to but somehow distinct from facts? And those may be interesting philosophical questions, but I don't think they matter here because Russell is so much related to the securities action that any reasonable interpretation of this release is going to subsume it. And to go back to a point I made briefly earlier, I don't know where it gets them to say, well, this was also released under paragraph 13 of the original agreement, and then it was released again. And that just means that the scope of each of those releases would be broad enough to bar this. That doesn't mean that the supplemental agreement isn't doing anything. The supplemental agreement is still doing things. It's still broadening the release. It's still affecting the securities action expressly, which had been carved out from the earlier release. So there's still a difference. There's still action happening when the supplemental release gets signed. But I don't understand, Consigo's argument, which is a new argument again, that, okay, so this was released under the scope of release of 13 of the original release, and therefore it doesn't make sense to read the release in October as also releasing it. I think that's non sequitur. That just doesn't make sense. Okay, so if the scope of release is already broad enough to release it, then it was broad enough to release it already. And then we have a supplemental release that comes along that says we supplant and expand the prior release. They still lose. So they lose on the first one and they lose on the broader one. It's a curious argument to me, unless I'm missing something, because I just don't think it gets them where they need to be anyway. There were some references by counsel to extrinsic evidence and who made changes to what on the original release. I think, we have a broad final contract with clear language that can apply. I don't think we need to go into that. If the court is interested, this was something that was pointed out, I think, in the briefing, and we can reference it if necessary, that, in fact, Conseco's lawyer involved in drafting this release from a sophisticated New York law firm could not remember who had requested this particular change or why. There were a series of complicated releases being signed by different carriers, and it's the evidence on this isn't as crisp as the sound bites perhaps we're getting from Conseco's lawyers on that, but I'm not sure at the end of the day it matters. RLI's lawyer drafting the release, in contrast, had sworn deposition testimony that he remembered making these changes to broaden the release. So I feel somewhat hesitant to take the bait and argue these new issues that were never argued before, because it may sound like, to your honors, that these are all fairly in play when they're not, just because it's what the lawyers are in front of you talking about. But just to make sure I do respond, though, I don't think that the evidence is going to support them anyway, and I think, as I said, read it narrowly, read it broadly, whatever. If we're going to give any meaning to this language, it's got to apply to Russell, which is, virtually overlapping the released securities action claims. The very damage, Russell is the purported class would be Conseco employees that were forced to hold this stock when its price was pumped up by false fraudulent security filings and then crashed in the wake of the restatement. The exact damage, the exact injury underlying his claim is the same injury that was underlying the securities action plaintiffs, which is why he was held to have released his claim and be barred by virtue of the prior settlement. Now, there were later some attempts to get around that with some temporal modifications to add in some post-release conduct, but it didn't change the fact the claims were certainly related and certainly in any way related, and that's why Conseco convinced Judge McKinney to dismiss the case, and he did so. And so we have argued judicial estoppel. I think it's hard to, think of a case where judicial estoppel is more appropriate than a case where they come in and make these broad arguments that these matters are related, indeed identical. They win, and then they turn around on the coverage action and say, well, no, they're not related. So we do argue judicial estoppel. I think judicial estoppel is very proper here. Judge McKinney, in his decision, noted the inconsistency in positions. Again, if we were talking about, out on the periphery, is there an interesting issue about the scope of release from the original underlying securities fraud plaintiffs, and it referenced facts and ours didn't. Again, those are interesting philosophical points. They don't matter to this case, because in this case, the matters are so closely related that we don't have to go that far. And Conseco wasn't arguing to Judge McKinney.
Mr. Pro, forgive me, but is your red light on?
Just went on.
I apologize, Your Honor. My binder was blocking it, so I realized. Okay. I'm happy to answer any questions Your Honors may have. Otherwise, I think I've addressed the main points.
Okay. I just want to be fair to Mr. Butler if you've gone over your lot of time.
You hit it right on the head, Alana.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Pro.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Butler?
3 minutes.
Thank you. Thanks.
With respect to Judge Williams, your question about the estoppel issue, whether these claims were, counsel had made a reference about the claims being made in the motion to dismiss. These issues that he quoted from that complaint, there's a list of 10, I think, in his response brief, and he talked about those. If you look at those, they all are relating to the underlying facts of the ERISA claim and the securities litigation. They're not talking about the release language that's the subject of this case. That motion to dismiss had to do with the underlying facts. That's the same distinction we're making. There's no inconsistent position, and we addressed this fully in the brief. With regard to the waiver issue, first of all, we raised the issue of the interpretation of the supplemental release in the court. That was what the whole case was about. We presented the supplemental release, the original release, the draft release, extrinsic evidence about the release, and argued about the interpretation of that release, and so did RLI. To suggest that this is a new argument is absolutely false. It's just not. This is the exact issue that was raised before the court. The court had a theory of interpretation of this thing. We disagree with that theory, and we're entitled to appeal that theory that the judge employed in interpreting this case. All the evidence was there. None of this is new. With regard to waiver on the mend the hold, if you look at page 7 and 8 of Conseco's motion for summary judgment and page 7 and 8 in their response to RLI's motion for summary judgment, if you look at Conseco's counterclaim to the Third Amendment complaint for breach of duty of good faith, these issues about the change of position are all raised. All of this has been raised before. And Judge, you asked earlier about the issue of, was this a common practice to wait 13 months and to look to do an investigation for 13 months under a reservation?
I didn't say 13 months. The reservation of rights and then going on with
right.
The defense.
Right, and it's not a common practice. When you have the reason of why you're going to deny a claim from day one, which is the release, that's the issue in this case. They had the release from day one. The very person who was writing this letters had this release. And he reserved his rights, but not under the – he reserved his rights not under the release, under the policy. And he did that for 13 months. This is not common practice to hold back the reason you're going to use to deny a claim a year and a month later. It's not common practice. This is exactly what the law on good faith and fair dealing seeks to prohibit, a change in position, deceiving the insured. Conseco went a year and a half defending a claim that it felt that it was insured on, because the only issue that RLI raised was the issue of coverage. And we knew, and RLI concedes in the district court, there's no issue of coverage when we come to suit. The district court noted that in its opinion. There's no issue of coverage. It was an issue of the release, and that was a change of position. I see I'm out of time, so we're asking for reversal in the case in its entirety. Thank you.
Thanks to both Mr. Butler and Mr. Pro, and the case will be taken under advisement.